Hi, everyone. Just a quick note before we start today's episode. If you follow us on social media, or if you've picked up a copy of our latest magazine, you'll know that we've just launched our crowdfunding campaign, Rewire the World. We're raising £50,000 for an issue of New Internationalist that exposes the global far right and tackles the politics of hate and division. Your donation will support our global network of journalists to take you to the heart of social movements that are rising up to tackle tyranny, offering unique perspectives you won't find elsewhere. Listen for yourself, and please, if you can, go to newint.org/give to make a donation. Thank you from all of us at the New Internationalist Media Cooperative.
Hi, my name is Nikita Jain. I am a journalist based in Delhi, India.
My name is Hamza Yusuf. I'm a British Palestinian journalist based in London.
Maya Masakir, and I'm a freelance reporter based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Stephanie Boyd.
It's all your son.
My name is Rose Belka Gumire, and I am a columnist at the New Internationalist. Today, we find ourselves in one of the most challenging times with the rise of the far right politics in many parts of the world.
People are scared, and that's understandable. And historically, when populations are frightened, they tend to turn to extreme movements.
These movements exploit economic grievances by redirecting public frustrations toward marginalized communities instead of the systems that breed oppression.
They tie into a lot of misinformation online. This is creating a lot of polarization.
Journalists, activists, advocacy groups, lawyers, a lot of my colleagues are in jail.
Having seen the New Internationalist and its coverage, having seen and been commissioned myself to cover things that the mainstream media simply wouldn't, I realize now more than ever that the mainstream media is failing us.
So now more than ever, we need independent media funded and protected.
So please support NI, and let's keep reading and writing and struggling together.
Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Maxine.
It's great to see you.
You too. Thanks for having me on.
You are a longtime contributor to New Internationalist and guest editor extraordinaire. You last edited our Palestine issue, which was published in 2023, and you're now hot off the press of our most recent issue, which is on treaty and indigenous sovereignty in Australia. Tell us a bit about the highlights from this issue.
Yeah, I guess before talking about the highlights, just to preamble that by saying like how difficult it was to determine the content of this issue. I mean, the theme of Indigenous sovereignty in Australia is as old, or if not older, than Australia's settler colonial histories. And there is no single Indigenous culture or political view or experience. I think what was important for me was to try and, I guess, capture some of the key themes and also some of the key voices that maybe don't filter up from Australia into the international sphere. So yeah, we had space for 5 pieces only. So the first of those is an interview with Dr. Gary Foley, who is a true veteran of the movement and just an incredible wealth of experience and insight as one of, to be honest, very few remaining voices as someone who's sort of seen that span of the Black Power movement and as well as those all those developments in Australian history. Our second piece is from Ben Abatangalo, who is a younger, also incredible voice. And his piece is on gas development in the Northern Territory outside Darwin. Australia is a highly extractivist country in terms of its economic constitution and so reliant on these resources, which are so often on Indigenous land. And so the theme of resource extraction and mining has been really key and deeply intertwined with the land rights movement and native title campaign. And then also we have an extract from Alexis Wright, which is really exciting. She's a renowned and really amazing voice, both as an activist, but also in terms of fiction and nonfiction writings. What I love about this extract is that it sort of reflects some of the complexity around storytelling in the Indigenous context and also like how deeply intertwined that storytelling is with Indigenous culture and politics and land. So I think that really comes across in this extract from her book Tracker, which is an incredible biography of the renowned activist Tracker Tilmoth. And our fourth piece is a feature on the campaign by Uncle Robbie Thorpe to sue the Crown for genocide. And I guess this is a really important theme because Australia is a nation that's founded on genocide. But I think that that reality often gets kind of airbrushed in terms of international perceptions of the country. And as Robbie and many other voices would argue, that genocide is ongoing in Australia. So it's really interesting to examine some different facets of that reality, but also the legal kind of context in which one can try to mount such a claim. Also, particularly in the context of the genocide in Palestine, extending that discussion to the context of Australia and looking at some of the links between those genocides and the international apparatus that enable them or that can be used to sort of hold people to account. And then finally, we have the interview with Lydia Thorpe, which is, obviously the foundation for our podcast today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is a very new topic to me, and I think it'll be a new topic for a lot of our readers and people who, you know, are just coming to this topic through this podcast. But can you talk a bit more about why this issue matters right now? Why should people care about Indigenous struggles in Australia in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, the point is that it's an issue that's always mattered. It's just a question of how much airtime or not, you know, it's been given in terms of political discourse, both in Australia and abroad. I mean, I think in terms of the present moment, the 2023 referendum on the Indigenous voice to Parliament was kind of, you know, it was a wake up call, I think, in many ways. Like, it was unfortunately a real vindication of how, you know, this racist settler colonial ethos in Australia really is still dominant. So I think for many people, yeah, it's a question of thinking about re-strategizing and also like, okay, Australia as a nation, it's clear, is not ready for something of that form. Even the most minor request, you know, that was represented in the referendum, the most watered down sort of appeal, I think people are now thinking about other forums, other alliances that can be built at a non-national level, both domestically and internationally. Because, I mean, despite this dominance and very slow to die racist colonial outlook, like, there is a lot of momentum in Australia from non-Indigenous Australians and a lot of support.
And on that, as an Australian living outside the country, what was your biggest takeaway from having worked on this issue?
I think the biggest takeaway was just how much there is to learn. Our education system in Australia is criminally sort of censorious in terms of our history. Granted, it has changed a lot in my lifetime, you know, since I was in education, but we're not exposed to any of these histories really at all. And so, like, the monolith of ignorance is pretty staggering. But I think at the same time, in thinking about the need for education, like, one of the things that struck me in some of the research for this issue was how tired a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders people are from carrying this burden of education, living with this monolith ignorance. And I think in light of that, yeah, it's all the more urgent that settler colonial Australia finally sort of takes some responsibility for learning.
So with that, we're just going to move into your conversation with Senator Lydia Thorpe now. Those who, even if you don't follow Indigenous struggles in Australia, I think will be familiar with Senator Lydia Thorpe when she went viral last year for confronting King Charles on his visit to Australia.
Lydia is an amazing figure. She's a really powerful voice in Australia and a very radical voice. And I think what makes her so interesting is that, you know, she's extremely radical, and yet she has made the choice to work within this colonial institution, i.e. politics, whose legitimacy she rightly disputes. So yeah, I was very grateful for her giving her time. She's an incredibly busy person, as you can imagine, on top of which it was like the middle of her summer break. So I was very persistent, and she was very generous. And she actually made time while on a road trip with her teenage daughter. She had pulled over the roadside and was talking to me from there, hence the slightly patchy reception. But yeah, also a reflection of how dedicated she is.
Yeah, and it's amazing to have that interview. It's really fascinating. So without further ado, we'll move right into that. But thank you so much, Zoe. Congratulations on this issue. It's fascinating. Really encourage people to read it. All of the links to subscription will be in our show notes. But thank you so much, Zoe.
Thanks, Maxine. And thanks again to Senator Thorpe.
So I'd like to start, I guess, by just asking you about your decision to enter parliamentary politics in Australia. Obviously, like, it's a land where sovereignty was never ceded. and you've pointed out that the Australian Parliament has no permission to be there. I'm just wondering if you can tell me a bit about the factors, or I guess the conditions maybe, that informed your decision to try and work within this institution that's like historically been so hostile to First Nations people.
Well, I've been an activist all my life. I've seen the destruction of my country, fought, you know, mining companies from other parts of the world who've tried to destroy my land, stood up to those, won big fights against these destructive companies. And I've been protesting outside Parliament, both state and federal, for a very long time also. And there came an opportunity because of my activism and standing in the community, where I was given an opportunity from the Greens Party through some really staunch Greens people, and ran for a pre-selection, a number of them. My uncle Robbie, who's been a mentor throughout my life, he said, "Lydia, you're the only one of us that can do it. You have to do it." And as soon as I got his blessing and my grandmother's and my mother's, I put my step, you know, I put my foot forward and did not expect to win any of those pre-selections, let alone get to where I am today. And I feel that, you know, yes, I'll continue to protest on the outside, but if I can infiltrate from the inside and educate this country on what is actually going on with those peoples here, then I may be more effective and certainly empowering to my people in fighting, you know, the oppression every day.
Would the world change if we taxed the super rich?
How can I think of the planet when I can't even afford my rent?
Will we ever see change in our lifetime?
These are the type of questions we're answering on the new season of the Greenpeace podcast, System Shift.
The thought of changing the world for the better can feel overwhelming.
That's why we're here. We'll get answers to some of the biggest questions facing our world.
And we'll show that change can happen in our lifetime.
Join us for season 3 of System Shift.
You're like part of the grassroots Black sovereign movement, but I guess sovereignty is a kind of term with a lot of different meanings and interpretations. So I'm wondering if you could tell me a bit about how you define sovereignty in this context.
Sovereignty is to me when you are from the land, you are from the water, you are from the soil, you are from the animals. You have an innate birthright back to country and connection back to country. You can't stick a flag into someone else's country like the invaders did, the colonial invaders, and say we are sovereign. It does not make sense. So our sovereignty is being with the land and with the water, and we carry that with us every day, and we maintain that balance of caring for our country, caring for our water. We're all assigned to totems, which we all have to look after. Mm. So it's a beautiful, you know, relationship with nature and the natural beauty of this land, which nobody can say ever that they have, except for the sovereign people.
You and a number of other kind of progressive no campaigners opposed the 2022 referendum on the voice to parliament. I'm wondering, especially, I guess, for our international audiences who are not really familiar maybe with that debate, like if you can just elaborate a bit, like on the reasons that you thought that that was going to be a bad thing for First Nations justice in Australia.
So we don't have a treaty in this country. We look at other colonised countries around the world, they have treaties, but we don't. Now, they came here, they set up a constitution in 1901 without our consent, without a treaty, and then they want to have a referendum and say, oh, you can come into our constitution, but you're going to have a little advisory body on the side that has no power And the people at the helm will be Anthony Albanese and Peter Dutton. Mm-hmm. They will be the ones that design what this voice looks like if that referendum were to succeed. Well, no, we are not bowing to the white man and the colonial system. We want a treaty before we start talking about going into the colonial constitution. They came here and set that up, a bunch of old white men, racist old white men, men that didn't even like women because women weren't included in the constitution. And it was back when they were setting up the White Australia policy. So anyone who wasn't white or wasn't a man was second rate. And so that constitution still today is racist, it's out of date, it discriminates not only against us, but it discriminates against LGBTIQ people, it discriminates against black and brown people, and it's all about upholding the parliamentary supremacy in this country, which is an illegal occupation. So until we have a treaty, we will decide what a voice looks like for us. Through the reconciliation process that they had 24 years ago, which my mother was a part of, the outcome of that whole decade-long process was that the country was too racist to reconcile. And I told Albanese that. I said, this country is not ready for a vote like the one you're proposing. It's going to cause harm. And we had a lot of people in the time of that referendum commit suicide. And he was told, the Labor government were told, but they wouldn't let us at the table because we were too radical and we want a treaty.
I guess, like, yeah, on that point, like, as you know, like, Indigenous people are, you know, amongst the most incarcerated population in the world. They're the poorest, the sickest. Like, what sort of, in practical terms, can you maybe give some examples of some of the most urgent fronts on which a treaty could help in policy terms?
It must uphold the principles of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, so that if you want to destroy our land, there's a process that you'll need to go through. It has to be free, prior and informed. And if you don't have that, then you don't have the consent. So you can't just pick and choose who's in bed with the government to give consent, which causes all kinds of harm to that local mob. We need to have proper processes in place that are self-determined by our people. Now, we look at, you know, people are on about the Northern Territory young people. Well, they're turning a blind eye on the fact that they've defunded youth programs. I went out to Yindamu, which is 5 hours out of Alice Springs. The government shut down the local swimming pool, childcare service, basketball stadium, after school homework class. Everything was bolted up, chained up, and children were starting to rob people's homes and get into other kinds of mischief. They shut down every youth service in that whole community. And what do you know? Kids got bored and started playing up. I can guarantee you that will be the case in 95% of the places where families and communities are reaching out to me saying, we need youth workers. We've got a great program going on here, but the government won't give us $100,000 for more youth programs or youth workers. So this is where the sophistication of the genocide comes in. It's smoothing the dying pillow. It's slowly killing us off and robbing us of the resources we need to self-determine our own solutions. And government walk in and out of our lives and dictate what is best for us, which doesn't work. It does not work. And so, you know, the removal rate of our children is not getting better, it's getting worse. Why is that? They're not supporting the parents. I have two kids from out-of-home care in my family, my grandkids, in fact, and their parents have no support. Yes, they're unwell. But they take these children and they say to those parents, go sort yourself out. You've got 2 years to sort yourself out. If you don't do it by then, we're taking your children forever. And that's what's happened with my grandkids. Their parents didn't get any help. It's been 2 years and the parents have got no hope of getting them back, although my son and daughter-in-law will always, you know, allow these kids to go back if the parents were well enough. But it's just take the kid, forget about the family, take the kid, and it's getting worse. And our children are being put in very unsafe situations and no one cares. And the police said there's so many kids missing that we just can't find them all. It's just too big a problem. These things infuriate me. Infuriate. You can't look for our kids, but you'll walk the streets and profile our men and lock our people up as quickly as you can, but you won't save our kids.
Yeah, it's so many sinister echoes of the past, really, isn't it? I just want to ask you also about your confrontation of King Charles during his visit to Australia last year, which obviously garnered you a lot of international support and attention. And during that, or after that that visit, you said you'd like the monarchy to take some responsibility and show some leadership. I'm interested if you can tell us a bit more about your previous efforts to correspond with the monarchy and the requests you made of them.
I haven't personally written to the monarchy or the colonial king about stolen goods. I know that my elders have. My elders have been flying over there to get remains and ask for remains for decades and decades. And I know that, you know, Uncle Kevin Atkinson and Ned Hargraves have been two of, we're talking about old men, in their 70s and 80s, flying around the world to beg for our people's remains. But what I did write to the king about was seeking a meeting with him and a discussion about treaty. I introduced myself to the Governor General and said, you know, we need to talk. I'd like to talk to you about treaty. This has been ongoing since I've been a senator because I wanted to use whatever power it means to be a senator in this country to say, hey, mate, let's have a chat about treaty. And it was a respectful letter. You know, it wasn't a protest letter. It was a respectful letter requesting a meeting. I had no response, And so I had a writ in my hand that day that he came and addressed the parliament. And that writ was from my uncle, Robbie Thorpe, and that was to serve King Charles with a genocide notice to appear in the International Court of Justice. Now, I wasn't able to give him that writ, so my ancestors said, get out there and send the message anyway. And I, you know, my ancestors, my old people, my land is all who I am. That's what makes me, and they drive what I do. So I don't know if I were going to be able to confront him in the way that I did if I didn't have my ancestors guiding me and my old people supporting me. So that's why I did it. That's how I did it. And I do it again and again and again and again until we get justice in this country.
Hi there, I'm Paula and I'm the editorial assistant at New Internationalist. If you've picked up a copy of our print magazine, you'll have seen our upfront news section, Currents, where we publish underreported stories, mostly from the Global South. For those of you that prefer your news paperless, Currents is now available as an exclusive newsletter, delivered straight to your inbox twice a week. We work with journalists from around the world to give a platform to stories that the mainstream media sidesteps, as well as ways to keep up with and support global progressive movements. For example, in the past week, we've reported on the Rojavan civilian resistance facing Turkish drone strikes and the court case against the Danish government for supplying F-35 fighter jets to Israel. The current newsletter is included with print and digital subscriptions to New Internationalist, or you can sign up now via the link in the show notes to get your first month of the newsletter free. After that, it's just £3 a month. Thanks for your support, and we hope you like it.
I just want to ask you finally as well, I guess, like, you know, that act, even though the, you know, reception in Australia, the mainstream media at least, was depressingly hostile, like it really got a lot of, I think, international support. And I'm just wondering if you can tell me a bit like about the importance, I guess, to that international solidarity for First Nations people. And I think also, I guess, in the context of the Palestine genocide in particular as well, because you've been so vocal on that.
Feedback I've had internationally has given us all strength to continue our resistance globally. And that's the love that I have felt from that act of defiance or resistance. But I also saw what this country did and how this country responded. And it's typical. Typical response from a racist nation who's denying our sovereignty and who are guilty of war crimes and who have stolen a lot of wealth and lives of our people. So I knew that this country would react the way that they did. I didn't expect the support internationally, and when I got it, My people were proud to be black again because they saw and they felt that international connection and solidarity, and we're continuing to grow that. That's one of the you know, my top priorities for the remainder of my time is to continue to build that international solidarity. We need truth telling so that we can bring the whole nation along on a journey to know who it is, to be connected to our land like we are, have an appreciation for the water that you drink, because it might not be there in 50 years' time. So let's work out how we're going to fix this land and water together for future generations. And if you want to celebrate a day, well, let's celebrate Treaty Day in this country. Let's bring it together. But We have to capitalise and use every platform for truth-telling, state and nationally, and continue down that path. And we can do local treaties. We don't need to wait for government or politicians to do treaties. I'm talking to other nations about treaties with my clans and my people, and that's what we're doing around this country. We're bypassing the politicians, we're bypassing the colonial illegal occupation, and we're talking internationally and treating with other nations on a global scale.
That was New Internationalist guest editor Zoe Holman in conversation with Senator Lydia Thorpe, who represents the Black Sovereign Movement in Australia's federal parliament. If you're inspired by what you heard today, please consider subscribing to New Internationalist to read our latest issue on Treaty, Indigenous Sovereignty in Australia. Check out our show notes, where you'll find a link to subscribe, and don't forget to use the code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout for 20% off the first year of your print and or digital subscription. That's it from us. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. We'd love to hear what you think of it. You can give us a rating in your podcast app, or you can email us directly with your comments and feedback to submissions@newint.org. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey, and Zoe Holman is the guest editor of our latest issue. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuz. Audio editing is by Naseek Hamza. Special thank you to the folks at Impress, the UK's independent media regulator, for helping us get this podcast off the ground. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.